Jamie rode out the next morning and picked up the trail of those who had escaped his attack. They were heading north and slightly east and making no attempt to hide their tracks. Days later, they crossed over into Colorado and were forced to stop at a trading post on the Animas River. Their horses were just about done in. The ragged and worn down outlaws staggered into the trading post and up to the bar.
Whiskey.
You boys got law trouble?
If we do, it ain't none of your concern.
Don't sass me, sonny boy. It's my business if you bring trouble in here.
The barkeep peered closely at the four men, then cut his eyes to the wanted poster tacked up behind the bar. The man was reaching for a gun under the counter when Stone smashed his pistol down on the man's head. Jeff dragged him off through the curtained archway and tied him up in a storeroom.
We ain't seen no sign of that bastard trailing us in days. Now, we ain't lost that law dog. We got a good 2 days on him, way I figure. Time enough for us to swap horses and stock up on food and such. Let's get some grub going. I'm half starved.
Nate stoked up the fire in the stove and began slicing bacon, while Carter was rummaging through the stacks of men's breeches and shirts to replace their own stinking and filthy clothing. None of the four outlaws even thought about taking a bath. Their bellies full of hot food, wearing clean clothing, the men relaxed at one of the rough tables in the bar of the trading post, drinking whiskey.
Well, what happens if someone comes in here looking to buy something?
Hell, we sell it to them. Then we shoot them.
Another bottle of whiskey was open, and they gave no thought to the law dog who'd been trailing them for days. The man they assumed to be a lawman had picketed his horses about a half mile from the lonely trading post and was now slipping silently toward the building, coming up on a windowless blind side. Jamie had left his rifle in the boot and was carrying his sawed-off double-barreled shotgun. He tried the outside entrance to the storage room. Inside, the owner of the trading post had regained consciousness. He looked up at one of the biggest and meanest-looking men he'd ever seen. He realized it was Jamie instantly, for the man was a Colorado legend. Jamie swiftly cut the ropes that held the man and then put a finger to his lips. The man nodded in understanding and held up four fingers, cutting his eyes to the main part of the long and low building. Jamie nodded and moved toward the curtained archway, easing back the hammers on the greener as he walked. The post owner lay on the floor and smiled through his headache. Jamie slipped through the curtains and stood for a moment, looking at the four men drinking. Carter Young was the first to spot the big man standing in the shadows of the room, the greener in his hands. His eyes widened and his mouth dropped open.
Stone?
What? Man, you look like you just seen a ghost.
I wish I had.
Oh, shit.
I can take you back to Valley for a trial and a hanging, or we can end it here. Whichever ways you boys want it is fine with me.
As if one mind controlled them all, the four men threw themselves away from the table. Jamie fired the instant he saw the men tense. Young caught a full load from one barrel, and Hooks took the second one. Jamie dropped the greener and hauled iron just as Clapton was filling his hands. Jamie fell into a crouch and disappeared behind the bar just as Stone fired. He popped out at the other end of the bar and dusted Stone twice. Stone snapped off a shot that nicked Jamie's left shoulder. Jamie leveled his right-hand pistol and drilled Stone in the center of his forehead. It was over.
Hot damn! I've seen some sights in my time, and this one wins a prize. That was some mighty fine shooting, McAllister.
You can have their personal belongings and their horses and saddles. That'll help ease that lump on the back of your head some.
Damn sure will. Let me tend to your shoulder first, and I'll drag this trash out of here and drop them in a hole. I buried a horse the other day and haven't had the time to shovel in much dirt. I'll dump them at the south end. That's where the horse's ass is.
The trading post owner pointed to Stone as he dipped a clean cloth into hot water.
That one there's a ringleader to this pack of piss ants. I heard him talking about them women they raped. It was disgusting.
Jamie pulled a scalping knife from its sheath and knelt down beside Stone Gibson. The trading post owner watched unemotionally. 2 weeks later, the residents of Valley silently lined the streets and watched as Jamie rode down the main street. They all saw the scalp tied to Sundown's mane. A young federal marshal stood with Matthew in front of the sheriff's office. He was relatively new to the West and was still appalled by what he considered to be highly barbaric behavior by some Westerners. He grimaced at the sight of the human hair hanging from the mane of the big horse.
Is that what I think it is?
It is.
Who is that rough-looking old man?
My pa. That, sir, is Jamie Ian McAllister.
And that, scalp means he got one of the men who attacked your sister and niece?
No, sir. That means he got them all.
But acting without authority, and certainly without due process.
Hey, Pa! Jolene opened her eyes about 2 weeks ago. She's up and doing fine.
Jamie shook hands with his sons, ignoring the young man with the badge pinned to his suit coat.
How's Kathy Lou?
She'll be all right, Pa. She just needs a lot of love and care.
Those criminals you pursued were wanted by the government for mail robbery and assault on a federal officer, McAllister. I'll need a full report from you, and I expect it promptly. I also...
Shut up.
I beg your pardon?
I said shut up. I was speaking to my sons, not to you. When I'm finished speaking with my family, which is going to take the rest of the day and a good part of the evening, then I'll get around to you. Meanwhile, just stand aside and be quiet.
Jamie was content to stay close to home after his return, at least for a while. He thought occasionally of Logan, Red, Camby, and Rick, and wondered if they'd made it into and out of the Muggyones with their hair. In late 1873, Jamie received a message from the War Department in Washington, D.C. An expedition into the Black Hills of Dakota was being planned, and they wanted Jamie to be one of the scouts. Jamie wired back, asking who would lead the expedition. The reply was, Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer. At first, Jamie refused, for he knew Custer from the War Between the States, and he didn't like the man. Truth be told, Jamie considered Custer to be nothing more than a flamboyant fool, an opinion that was shared by many career Army men. Custer had been a general at War's End, but was then reduced to the rank of captain. But that didn't last long. In less than a year, he had been leapfrogged over more qualified men and was promoted to lieutenant colonel in the 7th Cavalry, which was being formed up at Fort Riley, Kansas. Since he had arrived in the West, just after the War Between the States, Custer had been involved in many skirmishes with the Indians, not always coming out victorious. And to those who studied such things, and Jamie did whenever he could get his hands on the manuals, it proved that Custer was a man who possessed a fatal weakness in the area of tactics. As Jamie knew from long years of experience, when dealing with Indians, perhaps the greatest guerrilla fighters that ever lived, one had damn well better understand tactics. And Jamie understood that while no one could call Custer a coward, Custer was not always faithful to his men. At the Battle of Washita River, it was rumored that Custer left Major Elliott and 19 of his men to die. Now, while that accusation was never really confirmed, from that day forward in 1868, Custer never again regained the full loyalty of his officers in the 7th Cavalry. But the truth of the matter was, Jamie was getting bored. So he saddled up and rode down to the telegraph office and wired the War Department he would agree to scout for the Black Hills expedition. Much to Jamie's surprise, Lieutenant Colonel Custer personally wired him as soon as he heard the news and expressed great delight that the famous commanding officer and guerrilla fighter in the recent unpleasantness was going to join his command.
What's this all about, Pa?
Gold, honey. That's the bottom line. The Army says he's going to look for a northern railroad route through Dakota and Montana, and I'm sure they are, but the bottom line is gold.
But Falcon says that part of the area is sacred to the Indians.
He's right, especially the Sioux. And when gold is confirmed in the Black Hills, the miners will come swarming like ants to honey.
And?
And there'll be trouble. I suspect another reason for this expedition is to locate a good spot to build a fort.
After his kids had left and the cabin was silent, Jamie stood for a moment, looking at the pictures of Kate on the mantle and on the tables around the large room. He stepped outside to stand on the porch. He looked up into the impossible blue of the Colorado sky.
I got me a hunch, Kate. I got me a feeling that I'm going to be seeing you before too much longer. Custer's a fool, honey. I may be a bigger fool for riding with him. I guess we'll just have to see.
Sundown was raring to hit the trail when Jamie threw his saddle on him and led him around to the front of the cabin. He was to link up with Custer and his men at Fort Abraham Lincoln in the Dakotas, on the west bank of the Missouri River and just north of the Cannonball River. Jamie stood for a moment, looking down at Kate's grave on the ridge below him.
Yeah.
Jamie rode down the mountain, pack horse trailing. The day was uncommonly warm for this time of year, and Jamie felt the years being blown away from him. This was his destiny. This was his way of life. He was no more cut out for a rocking chair than an eagle was to be confined in a cage. Jamie didn't want to die in a bed, long-faced family members hovering about. This was where he should fight the final fight, out under man above skies. Only one thing wrong with that. He wanted his bones to lie beside Kate. That was a small detail he'd have to ruminate on some.
Colonel McAllister, how good of you to join us. But a grand adventure awaits us in the Black Hills. We'll have at least 3 newspaper correspondents accompanying us, and several prospectors, too.
Just the column itself was impressive. 110 wagons accompanied the 7th Cavalry as they pushed off from Fort Abraham Lincoln in early summer 1874, heading for the Black Hills, the most rugged and remote part of the Sioux Reservation, located in the western Dakotas. Lieutenant Colonel Custer was a happy man. He was back in the field again, and he did cut a resplendent figure, dressed in his buckskins, the sun shining off his long yellow hair. George Armstrong Custer sat a horse well, although that was about the only thing he did well. He was unaware up to his death that a few years before, General Sherman had written to a friend, "George A. Custer appears not to have much sense." The band was playing gaily as the 7th moved out that day, to Custer sure they were heading for fame and glory. His wife, the lovely Libby, waved her hanky at her man. Custer's pets carried on. The couple had no children, but Custer did have his pets. Lord, did he have his pets. He had a tame mouse and a not-so-tame wolf. He had a raccoon and an opossum and 40 dogs, and a pelican he had captured on the Arkansas River. Custer would on occasion carry the mouse in his long flowing hair. It was quite a shock to visiting guests to see the mouse running around the general's head, occasionally peeking out through the flowing locks. Jamie was amused by all the hoopla as the long column snaked its way out of the fort and headed west. Custer was certain his 7th Cavalry would encounter many hostiles during this expedition and return with souvenirs of glorious victories. But Jamie knew something that Custer didn't. Tribes that occupied the area around the Black Hills were gone. They were in Montana for their annual summer's reunion. Jamie kept that information to himself, not wanting to put a damper on Custer's euphoric mood. When George was in a good mood, he was an amusing and charming fella. When he was in a bad mood, he became petty, demanding, red-faced, and sullen, and he stuttered. Despite all that, George Armstrong Custer was a man of undeniable courage. He would, without argument, charge through the gates of hell in pursuit of an enemy. He just didn't have any common sense. Jamie scouted far ahead of the long column, choosing the best places to camp for the night and the best places to ford the rivers. As always, on this expedition, George would suddenly leave the column to go hunting by himself. But George had a lousy sense of direction and never strayed too far from the main column. Not since several years back when he had galloped off to go buffalo hunting, but instead of shooting the buffalo he found, He accidentally shot his horse in the head, killing the animal instantly. Miles from the column, in the middle of hostile Indian territory, he was lost. He finally followed his dogs back to the column. Since that episode, George had become much more careful about straying too far from the dust of his soldiers. Whenever possible, George would ride with Jamie and was always after him to relate stories about the fight at the Alamo, his life with the Shawnee, and of the many adventures in Jamie's long years on the frontier. Consequently, Jamie tried to stay miles ahead of the column and away from Custer. Jamie didn't have a real high opinion of the man. The weeks wore on, and the days became a blur. Not a single Indian was spotted. The column pushed on. Custer didn't find his Indians, but he did find that the area offered the white man timber, game, and thousands of acres of grazing land. And the prospectors riding with Custer found gold. In late fall of 1874, Jamie, with permission, left the column and headed south. His work was finished. More than gold was found in the Black Hills. Silver, beryl, feldspar, and mica were also discovered. The Black Hills was soon called the richest place on earth. When the column finally returned to Fort Abraham Lincoln in late 1874, and the reporters could get their stories out and back to the eastern newspapers, the stampede west began, and the Indians had no choice but to fight. This land had been given to them, promised in writing to be theirs forever and ever. But once again, the white man had broken his word. Jamie had angled some west and rode down through southeastern Wyoming. He stopped at a trading post near Fort D.A. Russell.
"You farty old dog!"
Jamie turned to see Red, Logan, Canby, and Rick sitting at a table in the far corner.
"I heard you was scouting for the army."
"I was. One time only, with Custer. What you boys up to?"
"Prowling around. We got out of the muggy owns in the nick of time, with about 100 screaming savages right behind us. Damned unfriendly bunch of heathens. Where they was acting, you'd have thought we goosed the chief or humped his wife or something."
"We heard you caught up with them old boys that done them terrible things to your kin."
"That I did."
"You still got people after your hide, Mr. Mack. That crazy damn Ace of Pike and them Jones boys are still prowling around making threats."
"I can't be worried about that pack of nitwits. But I can guarantee you boys one thing. If they ever show up in Valley, they'll be dead within an hour. My son Falcon doesn't make idle threats."
"Yeah, we sort of got that impression."
"Where are you boys wintering?"
"We thought we'd head down to Texas, maybe. Hey, Jamie, you remember Rick here telling us about all them Kermit brothers being after him?"
"I do."
"Well, whole pack and passel of them is down Texas way. They bought him some sort of ranch down yonder. They're a crazy bunch, heavy into thieving and rustling, but they pass themselves off as lovers of the Lord. We thought we'd amble on down there and get him off the boys' back and do the sheriff a favor whilst we's at it."
"Sounds good to me. Where in Texas?"
"Some little two-by-twice town just north of the border called Eagle Pass."
"Well, hell, I've never been there."
"Wanna go?"
"Sure, why not? Let's provision up and put some miles behind us. That's a far piece from here."
"We got us some gold, Mr. Mack."
"Oh, you hit yourself a strike in Muggy Owns, did you?"
"Not no mother load, but enough to carry us for a time without worrying where our next meal was coming from."
"That's always a good feeling. You boys ready to go?"
"Ain't no moss growing on my feet."
The men headed south and slightly west, happy to be together again. They pushed on, riding by the ruins of Bent's Fort in southeastern Colorado, crossing into Oklahoma territory, and into Texas before heading straight south through the bitter cold and blowing snow of the North Texas winter. They were running out of supplies and half frozen when they spotted the outline of a trading post, seemingly sitting smack in the middle of nowhere. The men stabled their horses out of the wind and saw to the animals' comfort, and then walked into the long, low building.
"God damn! Was that for real, or is this hell?"
"Hell's hot."
"Oh, then I'd settle in for about 20 minutes of it."
"Howdy, gents. Come a fur piece, did you?"
"What happened to summer?"
"When it gets here, you'll be wishing it was winter again. Trouble with this country is there ain't no middle ground. It's either hot or cold. I got coffee and beef and beans, boys.
We'll pour it in and dish it up.
Whiskey first. My innards is froze solid.
Where are you boys heading?
Eagle Pass.
Maverick County. That's bad country, boys. Even this fur north of there, I can tell you, that's Kingfisher's country.
Oh, who the hell is Kingfisher?
Started out as a gunslick and a rustler. Now he calls himself a rancher. He's a bad un. The king runs that county. Now I hear he's thrown in with some bad boys named a Kermit.
Is that a fact?
Sure is. Was I you boys, I'd fight shy of that area.
One thing about it, it'll be a damn sight warmer down there than it is here.
You do have a point, but fired lead's hotter than ice, too.
Since his initial run-in with the Kermit brothers and kin some time back, Rick had grown a handlebar mustache and had fleshed out some due to eating regular.
They might not recognize me right off, but it'll come to them sooner or later.
Damn sure warmer down here than up north. My bones is finally thawing out. I might just decide to live out the rest of my days down here.
Well, we might not. None of us have no choice in the matter. We might all get planted down here.
You are such a joy to have along. Just full of good cheer and such.
I just wonder if this Kingfisher character is going to pitch in with the Kermit boys.
We'll know soon enough. Eagle Pass is about 10 miles from here.
Well, I hope they got a good cafe in town. I'm right hungry.
Logan, I never known you when you weren't hungry.
In the small border town, the men stabled their horses and then found rooms. After cleaning up, they went looking for a cafe and had an early supper. After eating, they sat on benches in front of the general store and smoked and eyeballed the few riders that came in. If there was any local lawman, he was either gone home for the evening or gone out of town, for no badge toter came near him.
I think I'll amble over to that whiskey shop across the street and keep my ears open and see what I can pick up. I'll be back.
Jamie opened his watch and checked the time. It was a few minutes before 5 o'clock on this late winter's day, and the light was fading fast. Logan returned after a short time and took a seat.
This Kingfisher person is out of the country, I believe. But the Kermit brothers come into town most evenings after supper. They're usually at the saloon over yonder by 5:30, and they'll drink for about an hour and then eat. They've thrown in with Fisher. And from what I could overhear, Fisher has this town buffaloed. Not just the town, but the whole damn county and a lot of the surrounding area. What law there is around here is in Fisher's pocket.
How many Kermits are there?
8 brothers, a whole lot of cousins and nephews and what have you, and they're all big and mean and good with a gun.
Sounds to me like these Kermits plan on horning in on Fisher's play.
It shapes up that way, doesn't it?
Too bad we can't just wait around for them to kill off each other.
There ain't no time left to worry about that. I believe those are the Kermit brothers and kin riding in now.
Ooh, Jesus me. Looks like about 2 dozen of them.
Plenty to go around, for sure.
Ugh, shit.
What's the matter, Red?
I believe I'm gonna see the elephant tonight. But I couldn't check out with no better friends around me.
What brought all this on?
Just a feeling, that's all. But a damn strong one.
Probably indigestion. You ate about 10 pounds of beef.
Nope. Tonight's the end for me. My goal's yours, Rick. Take it and buy yourself a spread somewhere. Make something out of yourself. You're young. You got plenty of time to do that.
I wish you'd quit talking like that. We got plenty of trails to ride yet.
This is track's end for me. You know what I'm talking about, don't you, Jamie?
I know.
You really believe you're going to cash in your chips tonight, Red?
Yes. And I ain't afeard of it. All I want is a nice box and a headstone. I'm trusting you boys to do me right.
You know we will.
And you can dance all around my grave, but not on it. Damn. Them Kermits sure are giving us the once-over, ain't they?
Yeah. I think they recognize me. The one standing and staring right at us is Percy Kermit. He's the oldest of the clan. Surrounding him is his brothers, Claude, Zeb, Zeke, Samuel, Calhoun, Temple, and Isham.
You know any of the others?
Few of their names. The fat one is named Fat Phil. The twins on the right is Dunk and Dank. Next to them is Abijah and Skinny.
We better go fetch our spare pistols. This here shootout is gonna be a jim dandy.
The men walked back to the small hotel, opened their bedrolls and saddlebags, and dug through their possibles, laying aside their spare pistols. They carefully cleaned the guns and loaded them up full, stuffing their pockets with spare cartridges before walking out of the hotel.
Don't make my tombstone nothing fancy now, you hear?
I swear to God, I'm gonna hit you on the head and tie you to a hitch rail if you don't hush up that kind of talk.
I've played out my string. A man knows when it's time. Y'all just heed my wishes now, you hear?
I seen one once have fat little angels dancing on it.
I don't want nothing like that. Just my name and the date I passed.
When was you born?
Hell, I don't know. I'm about 65 years old or thereabouts.
You're gonna live a good long time yet.
Well, at least another hour or so. But by God, I'm gonna go out with a smoke pole in each hand, and I'll take some of them damn Kermit with me.
Mr. Mac, did you ever get one of them feelings like Red's got?
No, but I have no men who did.
What happened to them?
They died shortly thereafter.
You see? God damn it! Told you!
Suddenly, two men stepped out of the alley and blocked the walkway. One of them held up a hand.
I be Abijah Kermit, and this here is my nephew, Thales. If you men has thrown in your lot with that filthy wife-stealing, raping, no-good fornicator Haynes, and you can die with him come the morning. We'll meet you all at delivery. Good night.
I ain't no fornicator, and I didn't wreck nobody. That damn woman chased after me, not the other way around.
You lie.
You damn Bible-spouting hypocrites. You go right straight to hell.
You'll feel the heat from the pits and the sting of the devil's pitchfork long before us.
We'll see you all at dawn. Make your peace.
That works both ways.
The two men stared at Jamie for a moment, then turned around and stalked off, disappearing into the darkness.
Boy, have you been fornicating when we wasn't looking?
Not lately.
I'm glad I ain't been. I'd hate to go to meet my maker with him knowing I'd just been a-fornicating something fierce.
Boys, does anybody here really want to wait till dawn to open this dance?
The returning smiles told them the answer.
Well, let's just go see what kind of a tune we can play this evening.
Jamie and the others pushed open the bat wings and stepped inside the smoky bar. They spread out. Those in the saloon who weren't Kermit's beat a hasty exit out the back door.
You men are fools. I gave you until dawn to make your peace with God.
We done that. He told us to come on in here and kick your ass.
You blaspheme.
I'm just telling you what he said. He said he don't have much use for hypocrites like y'all.
Permission to speak, cousin?
Go ahead, Eli.
The Lord has delivered our enemies into our camp. It's God's will that we obey the sign and destroy them.
I do believe you're right, Eli.
What a bunch of bloomin' digits.
Yeah, I believe the Lord has delivered us into this den of sin for a reason, and I sure wouldn't want to disregard no message from the heavens.
Oh, well, my goodness, no.
You'll all burn in hell.
All right, all right. Now look, this doesn't have to be. Rick's a good boy. We believe he's telling the truth about what happened. The woman chased him, not the other way around.
He's a lying fornicator.
You be right, Ham.
I do believe we've talked long enough. I think it's time to read some from the scriptures.
Claude Kermit grabbed for his guns, and Logan shot him in the belly.
Oh!
Kermit and Ken all jumped to their feet. Jamie dragged Iron and dropped Percy with a bullet to the head. Rick lined up Fat Phil and put the puss gun on the floor. Jamie dropped to one knee and put lead into a man who was aiming at Red. Tammy stood with a pistol in each hand, blasting away with terrible results. Jamie saw Red take a bullet in the chest. The big man staggered back. He smiled, then he dropped his empty pistol, jerked full-loaded guns from behind his belt.
I'm a ring-tailed tooter from way back, and it'll take more than that to put me down, you damn pack of heathens!
Hit!
Jamie felt the whip and sting of a bullet cut a groove in his cheek as yet another bullet took off a small chunk of flesh from his upper left arm. Jamie took aim through the smoke and confusion and ended the days of Zeb and Zeke Kermit. Red was down on his knees, his face and chest bloody. He emptied one gun into the knot of Kermit's and Ken, did a fast border roll, and emptied his second pistol. Before falling over to one side, his pistol slipped from his suddenly numb fingers. Enraged at the sight, Logan jumped right into the middle of the group of Kermit's. His big bowie knife flashing back and forth, each slash reddening the razor-sharp blade. Dunk and Dink went down, eyes wide with shock, gaping holes in their throats. Jamie took splinters from the bar in one side of his face, and the blood poured out. Ignoring the sting and the wetness, he jerked freshly charged pistols from his belt and began pouring out the lead. Temple and Isham Kermit went down under the rolling and deadly thunderous barrage, just as Canby ended the days of Samuel and Calhoun. Rick jerked sawed-off shotgun from pegs behind the bar and fired both barrels into several cousins and nephews. Jamie watched through unbelieving eyes as Red staggered to his boots and emptied a six-gun into the chest of Ham Kermit. Then the big man turned, his eyes meeting those of Jamie, his smile bloody.
See you on the other side, Mac.
As suddenly as it had begun, the fight was over. The bar room was filled with thick gun smoke, the acrid smell mingling with the sharp odor of blood. Only two of the Kermit kin were unhit and able to stand, Grattan and Cornelius. They stood with their hands empty and in the air. Their eyes were wide and disbelieving at what had just happened in the saloon. Only two of the eight brothers were still alive, Claude and Temple, and they were badly wounded. Jamie reloaded, then pulled what splinters he could from his face and wiped away the blood.
I believe that just about ends your problem with the Kermits, Rick.
Damn sure does.
Jamie and his friends looked over at Red. He had died with what appeared to be a very faint smile on his lips. Logan walked over to him and knelt down. With his fingertips, he very gently closed Red's eyes.
Have a good journey, old partner. I'll be along someday. Then we can ride together forever.
Rick was struggling with his emotions, fighting to keep the tears from rolling down his cheeks. He lost the battle and let the tears flow. Grattan Kermit scowled.
Well, look at the little baby cry.
Canby closed the distance between him and hit Grattan across the jaw with the barrel of his pistol. Canby turned to Cornelius.
You got anything you want to say?
No, sir. Nothing at all.
Fine.
Logan looked at the bartender, who had just a moment before gotten up from the floor behind the bar and was dusting himself off.
You got an undertaker in this burg, barkeep?
Yes, sir.
Go fetch him.
What about our kin?
What about him?
Well, they need a doctor.
Claude Kermit, trying to rise, made the mistake of pointing his pistol at Logan. The old mountain man shot him between the eyes.
Dad don't need a doctor no more.
You foul, evil old man.
Old, I'll go along with, sonny. But foul and evil suit you more than me. Now shut that blowhole of yours before I take a notion to save you a doctor's visit, too.
Cornelius closed his mouth and kept it shut. Rick and Canby gathered up all the weapons from the dead and wounded, toted them out back to drop the whole kit and caboodle down the opening of a one-hole privy. Grattan was getting to his feet, holding his busted jaw, when the undertaker and his helper arrived. The undertaker smiled and rubbed his hands together at the sight. There were dead bodies all over the place.
You do our man here first, undertaker, and you do him right. We'll bring you clean clothes within the hour.
Red was buried the next morning, a cold, windy, overcast day in South Texas. No one knew what his first name was, or if Green was even his Christian last name. After the short service, the men didn't linger long at the gravesite. They said their goodbyes to Red and rode out of town, following the Rio Grande north. 2 days later, sitting at a table in a cantina, the men toasted the memory of Red Green.
Well, I think I'll head back home. I don't figure any of my brothers or sisters is still living. Or even if they was, they'd want to see me, but I ain't never seen my parents' graves. I think I ought to do that.
I think I'll head up to Fort Stockton and hook up with a party that's maybe heading to California. Hell, I might decide to spend the rest of my days out yonder. You've been out there, ain't you, Mick?
Oh, yeah. Some years back. The weather's nice year-round.
Hey, Rick, you got Red's gold, and with your share, that makes a tidy poke. You ought to think about settling down. Marry up with a nice young woman and stop all this wandering.
Now, what woman would want me?
Oh, I know a place just full of single gals. Most of them blonde-headed and blue-eyed.
You don't say.
Sure do. And I know where there's a nice piece of land for sale to the right person. It's 10 sections. A man could raise horses, run some cattle, have him a nice garden. And I know the president of the bank right well, too. Land could be got for a fair price.
That sounds good to me.
We'll pull out at dawn, then. It's a long ride.
Well, I guess it's trail's end, boys. But I want to tell you all this. I ain't never ridden with no better men. Nah, I ain't much for mushy goodbyes. So I'll just finish this drink and walk out of here. Nobody needs to say no more.
The men nodded their heads and watched as the old mountain man drained his glass and stood up and walked out of the cantina. Canby downed his drink and stood up.
See you boys around.
He tossed him a salute and walked away.
I ain't never going to forget them men.
Nor they us.
I used to think all I ever wanted to do was ride the trails, Mr. Mack. But now I realize that a man's got to have a home. Something solid to hold on to. Logan's never had that, and neither has Canby. Except for all them years in the army. Now I reckon I want more than that out of life.
I've been talking around. It's about 85 miles straight north to a trading post. We'll make that and provision again there. And ride up on through the plains and angle some west. We'll be home when the mountain flowers are just beginning to bloom.
That sure has a good sound to me, Mr. Mack. But then what'll I do?
You can build you a cabin, hang those guns up on a peg, and for the most part, leave them there. Then you can go courting.
And I'll have me a home.
That you will.
Logan rode west, Canby rode east, and Jamie and Rick headed north. Red lay in his grave just outside of Eagle Pass, but the five of them had broken the back and cut off the head of the Kermit gang in a shootout that would become legend. Jamie and Rick rode across the once-empty plains that were not so empty anymore. Pioneers were pushing steadily westward, building their lonely cabins with the only company the whine of the wind and the howl of the coyote. In another 25 years, the panhandle of Texas would be dotted with small towns and settlements. The two men crossed the windswept and lonely plains and provisioned at a trading post near the juncture of the Mustang and Carrizo Rivers, spent a day and a night there, resting their horses and themselves. They crossed into Oklahoma territory, an area that was rapidly filling with outlaws on the run and assorted other riffraff and dropouts from the human race. They had just made camp and had the coffee ready when a voice called out from the gathering shadows.
Hello, the camp!
Come on in! But you better be friendly.
I'm friendly if you are. I'm a U.S. Marshal on the hunt for three murderers.
Pat Riordan. It's been a while since I've seen you.
Jamie McAllister. Well, I'll be damned.
The two men shook hands and Jamie introduced Rick. Pat led his horse in and up to the picket line and saw to its need before seeing to his own. Then he settled down and accepted a cup of coffee.
Who are you looking for?
Twins named Dunk and Dink Kermit, and a cousin of theirs called Rip.
They're all dead.
Jamie recounted the shootout.
Good. You got several $1,000 of reward money coming, Mac.
Give it to Rick here. Have it sent to the Bank of Valley, Colorado. In his name. He'll be settling there.
Fair enough. So, you boys wiped out nearly the whole damn gang? Hell, you done something in 5 minutes that we've been trying to do for 5 years.
We tend to take a more direct course than you boys.
Yeah, I can attest to that for a fact. So what now, Mac?
Home for both me and Rick. At least for a while for me.
Well, I can tell you that the Army's looking for you. There's trouble in the Black Hills. The government's made up its mind to settle it once and for all. They're sending Custer and his 7th Cavalry in. At least that's the way I heard it.
I may be up to one more ride.
Soon, Rick got his first look at McAllister's Valley.
It's beautiful, Mr. Mack.
That's what I thought first time I saw it, and I still think it is.
If I could have me a real home here, I don't think I'd ever leave it.
You couldn't find a better place, Rick. Come on, let's go home.
The first thing, the very first thing Rick noticed was all the good-looking women, most of them blonde-haired, blue-eyed. Even the ones with darker red hair had blue eyes.
Mr. Mack, you and your missus sure had a lot of offspring.
Well, yeah, Rick, we sure did. I guess I'm related to about 3/4 of the town.
Jamie got Rick settled into Lola's La Pierre Hotel, then walked down to the sheriff's office. Matthew had a worried look on his face.
Pa, don't do it.
What are you talking about, boy?
The Army wants to see you, Pa, right now. There's going to be a war with the Indians. They want you to scout for them.
The Army or the Indians?
Damn it, Pa, this is no laughing matter. We got all sorts of trouble here in Valley.
You want to tell me about it?
Some rogue Cheyenne warrior slipped into this area about a week ago. Kidnapped Falcon's wife. It all started about 6 weeks or so back. Some of her family came to see her. Said she was a traitor for marrying outside her race, or words to that effect.
Where was Falcon while all this was going on?
The first time or the second time?
Any of them.
When the family come to see her, Falcon was out in the county buying cattle. When they grabbed her, he was here in town. They done it in broad daylight.
Kids?
They're safe. They were over with friends.
Baby?
With Megan.
Falcon's out looking?
Sure, but you know better than any of us, if an Indian don't want to be found, they ain't gonna be found.
I know that Marie's mother is dead, and her grandparents are dead. We're about the only family she's got. If Falcon's looking for her in Colorado, he's wasting his time. Them that grabbed her carried her north, up into the Dakotas or Wyoming territory. All this was a warning to me, boy.
To keep you from scouting for the Army?
Yeah.
What are you gonna do, Paul?
After I resupply and let the horses rest, I'm gonna look for her. But don't nobody get their hopes up.
Why do you say that, Paul?
Because I think she's dead, that's why.
The next day, Jamie helped Rick buy some land and set up a line of credit at the bank. Morgan was decidedly and openly irritated by his father's seemingly cavalier attitude toward the kidnapping of Marie. After only a few minutes, Jamie set him straight, very bluntly.
Climb down from behind that pulpit, boy. I love Marie as if she was my own, but I know things about Indians that you'll never know. If it was the Cheyenne that took her, and I strongly doubt it was, they done so without tribal permission. Indians is no different from whites in that they got outlaws and trash among them just like we do. Those that took Marie probably were banished from some tribe a long time ago. They won't dare take Marie back into any village. They'd be killed if they did. You know damn well us in the valley made peace with the Indians more than 30 years ago, and they don't dare turn her loose for fear that Marie would point them out later. They used her and then killed her, boy, and then scattered her to the four winds. They'll never speak of what they done, not among themselves or to anyone else. If the various Indian tribes are gathering for a fight, as the Army thinks, them that took Marie will circle around and come in from the north to join up with the other warriors, if they'll have them. And they probably will if this is going to be an all-out war.
All right, Pa.
Now I'm going to look for Marie. The odds are I'll never find her. Falcon's going to be beside himself with grief. He'll want to do something real stupid. It's up to you other kids to prevent that. Now tell me what's been happening up in Black Hills.
Ben F. Washington, Matthew, and Jamie Ian II had been standing quietly near the pair, listening to Jamie unload on Morgan.
Thousands of miners have swarmed into the Black Hills, Mr. McAllister. They've settled and built a town in a place that some are calling Deadwood, and the Indians are going to fight.
Now how do you propose for us to keep Falcon here, Pa? Toss a loop around him in hog time?
If you have to.
I got me a mental picture of that. And the picture is us getting a hell shot out of us. Trying to dab a loop on Falcon would be like trying to rope the wind. You know damn well Falcon ain't gonna listen to but one person, and that's you, Paul.
And I'll stick around for a few more days. Guess there's no point in hurrying things.
You really believe Marie is dead, don't you, Mr. McAllister?
Yes, I do. And her kidnapping may have been done to try to provoke trouble between us and the few Indians remaining in this area. But it won't work. I'll go buy my supplies and get ready to pull out as soon as Falcon shows up and I settle him down. Or try to. Marie was the steadying influence in his life. With her gone, I don't even like to think about Falcon's future.
Jamie went to have lunch with Jolene and family. No one had mentioned Kathy Lou to him, and Jamie thought he had a pretty good idea why that was. Jolene confirmed it.
She's gone, Pa. We sent her back east to school. I don't think we'll ever see her again.
That's a mighty cold way of looking at it, child.
You taught us to be honest and speak our minds, Pa.
That I did.
If Marie is dead, what's going to happen to Falcon?
More importantly, what's going to become of the children?
Oh, you know we'll take care of them without hesitation, Pa.
Can you kids raise them knowing the Indian way? That was very important to Marie.
All we can do is try, Pa. I'm worried about Falcon.
It isn't like me and your ma, girl. Falcon's in his prime. He'll find someone else. He's too young not to.
You can't be sure that Marie is dead, Pa.
Well, I'm sure, girl. It's something that can't be explained. It's the Shawnee coming out in me.
You going to scout for the Army, Pa?
Probably.
You're 65 years old. Don't you think you deserve a rest?
Girl, I feel no older than 50. I'm not as spry as I used to be. I have some aches and pains on cold mornings that I didn't used to have. I can't hook and draw as fast as I once could. I gotta wear glasses when I read, but at a distance, I can outsee an eagle. And I can still sit in a saddle all day long, and I'm definitely not ready for a rocking chair and shawl.
When do you plan on pulling out, Pa?
Well, I've wired the Army and told them I'd scout for Custer. Maybe I can keep the fool from getting killed. But I'm not leaving until I sit Falcon down and talk to him.
Good luck with that.
Jamie left Jolene's house and walked the boardwalks of the town. He had a strange feeling that he couldn't shake loose. He had a feeling that he was seeing his town for the last time. Then he thought about Red down in Eagle Pass and the feeling that had come over his friend on that last evening on Earth for him. Falcon returned the next day at noon, looking gaunt and tired, and riding with a very short fuse. Jamie waited for Falcon to come to him. He knew he would. Jamie pointed to a chair on the porch.
Sit, son.
She ain't dead, Pa.
Well, maybe so, maybe not. But the odds aren't real good on the knot. You better start preparing your mind for that. Now do what I tell you and come here and sit down, damn it. That's better. I'm going out to look for her, son. I got eyes and ears out there in the big empty you'll never have. If Maria's alive, I'll find out.
I'll go with you.
No, you won't, boy. You got kids that need you to be home. They need you more right now than they ever have. And I won't brook no sass on the subject. You understand that?
Yeah, Pa.
I'll say my goodbyes in the morning and pull out. And son?
Yeah, Pa?
If what I suspect happened to Marie is true, don't let grief overtake you and turn you down the wrong trail, you hear? It's something you're gonna have to fight.
Yes, sir.
And don't let the wrong cards dealt too early turn you sour, neither.
I understand, Pa.
I hope you do, son. Now, shake my hand and go get cleaned up and get some hot food in you and get a good night's sleep. You look like a tree full of owls at the end of 40 miles of bad road.
Do I really look that bad, Pa?
Yeah, you do.
I'll see you before you leave?
I'll see all of you before I leave.
Is something wrong, Pa?
No, nothing. I reckon I just ate too much of Megan's good cooking, that's all.
All right. I'll see you in the morning, Pa.
Will you be staying out at your ranch?
No, I've got a room at the Wild Rose.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. All right. You sleep well, boy.
Jamie put on his jacket, stuffed his pipe, and sat back down in his chair on the porch, smoking and thinking. He looked down towards Kate's grave. He looked down at the lights of Valley far below him. Tomorrow he'd ride out of Valley. They all turned out to see Jamie off the next day. He waved at his kids, grandkids, great-grandkids, and his many friends, and pointed Sundown's nose north. He didn't look back. The seventh night out, Jamie spent with a small band of peaceful Indians who were not going to take any part in the upcoming fight, or so they said. But Jamie noticed they had no women with them and were packed for travel. He made no mention of that.
Bear Killer, you have always been a friend to us, so we will tell you what we know of Marie Gentle Breeze. Bad Indians planned to take her north against her will. She fought them constantly. They killed her, crushed her head with a war axe, and threw her into the colored river.
Did they rape her?
Many times. They thought by taking the woman they would gain much respect from others and be allowed back into the tribe. They were wrong. They are under sentence of death by the council.
Show me where they threw her body into the river.
The elder pointed to a spot on the map lines Jamie had drawn in the dirt.
There.
The Indian elder lifted his eyes and stared at Jamie.
Man who is not afraid should not ride with the soldiers. Not this time.
Jamie didn't push the conversation. He knew that warning was all he was going to get from the elder. For several days, Jamie rode and walked for miles on both sides of the river. He finally found what was left of Marie, and it wasn't much. Her remains were wedged in between a log and a large rock just a few feet away from the west bank of the river. Jamie gathered up what he could of Marie, handling the remains with as much dignity as was possible, considering the condition of the body, and then he buried her. He piled a mound of rocks over the grave and marked it carefully. Jamie rode over to the mining town of Georgetown, got himself a room at Louis Dupuy's fancy hotel to Paris, and sent word to Falcon. Sitting on the side of the bed in the luxuriously appointed room, with its solid walnut bed, hot and cold water taps over marble basins, and the finest of linens on the bed, Jamie suddenly realized he was tired, and it was only midday.
Age is catching up to me fast. Well, why not? How many times have I been shot and stabbed now? Hell, left for dead. All those things are finally taking a toll on me.
Jamie bathed and dressed in his one good set of clothing he'd brought with him, then walked down to the hotel bar. He was not expecting any trouble, for of all the mining towns in the West, Georgetown was now and always had been the calmest. And in the hotel, Louis would not tolerate no trouble of any kind, no matter who started it. While Bill Hickok made Georgetown his home for a time back in 72, and even he respected the hotel's reputation as a safe haven. That was not to say that Georgetown was not a whiskey-drinking, poker-playing, and whoring town, because it was. It just never saw much trouble. Jamie enjoyed two slow drinks of fine whiskey at the bar. Then Louis came in and motioned him over to his private table. He shook Jamie's hand.
It is an honor, monsieur. Your exploits are known worldwide.
Oh, thank you.
Do you ride north to fight the Indians, monsieur?
Yes, with mixed emotions.
I do understand both sides, I try to tell myself. But can a white man ever understand the Indian?
Louis, I have a long distance to travel, and I have a feeling that time is running out. I think my son Falcon will be along in a few days. Would you see that he gets this map, please?
But of course, consider it done.
Jamie rode out of Georgetown before dawn the next morning, heading north. He had told the army he would rendezvous with him on the Yellowstone, where Rosebud Creek flowed out of the Yellowstone. Falcon arrived at Georgetown a few days after his father had left and was given Jamie's message in a map. He immediately set out to find the grave of his wife, unaware that his arrival in and the quick departure out of the mining town had not gone unnoticed by a group of men who had just missed Jamie. The men followed the grieving Falcon from a safe distance. They would strike when the time was right. when it came to being dead, one Dan McAllister was just as good as the other. Falcon found Marie's grave and sat by it for a time, trying to make some sense out of her death. He couldn't. Falcon had brought along a heavy hammer and a chisel, and after looking around for a proper stone, he found one, muscled it into place, and began the laborious job of slowly chiseling her name into the stone. He was intent upon his work, but not so much that he failed to occasionally check his surroundings, for despite all the moves toward civilization, this was still the Wild West, and Falcon had been well schooled by his father. Falcon became aware that he was being watched, and not by Indians. Falcon allowed himself a very small smile. He had never seen any Indian this clumsy. He continued his work on the stone, but only after slipping the leather loops from the hammers of his pistols and checking to make sure his rifle was close at hand. After concluding that his watchers were at least six strong and probably more, Falcon made several trips to his packs, ostensibly for a drink of water, but really to stuff his pockets full of cartridges for his rifle and pistols. Then he would return to work on the stone. He worked and waited and wondered. With the waters of the Blue River softly flowing not far away, Falcon heard the men when they made their rush toward him. He turned, dropped to one knee, and drew his right-handed pistol all in one fluid motion. One of the Pike gang pointed a gun at Falcon.
I want him alive!
Falcon shot the man in the chest. He threw himself to one side as the men rushed him. He drew his other pistol and opened fire. Jones brothers, Lloyd and Bob, were among the first to go down, both of them mortally wounded. Falcon had no time to observe what Bob did next. He was in a fight for his life without having any idea why the men had attacked him. The fight was over in less than a minute. Falcon quickly reloaded and, with a pistol in each hand, began warily walking among the wounded, kicking pistols away from the men and out of reach.
Why?
A goddamn McAllister, that's why. We Pikes. And I saw Asa right off. He'll be back. You can bet on it.
Oh. After burying the dead man in a mass grave, Falcon spent the rest of the day finishing the marker for Marie's resting place. Then he tidied up the area and stood for a time by Marie's grave. Falcon put his hat on his head, walked to his horse, and rode away without looking back. He didn't know where he was going. He was just riding. He headed west toward Utah. Falcon wanted only to ride away his grief. Just be alone for a time and let the wind and the rain help cure the ache deep inside. After getting himself a room in the small hotel in a tiny town in Utah, Falcon went down for a drink and something to eat. Much of the grief he'd been carrying had left him, but he still preferred to be left alone. He took his bottle and glass and went to a far corner of the saloon. Two men walked in, one wearing a sheriff's badge, the other with a federal marshal's badge pinned to his suit coat. Falcon wasn't interested in them and paid them scant attention as they strutted up to the bar.
Whiskey.
Here too.
Falcon returned to his whiskey and his sorrowful thoughts and ignored all the others in the saloon. But Falcon was his father's son. He could smell trouble, and the lawmen had it written all over them. To begin with, they were both small men, about 5'6" or 7", and both walked like they had something to prove. And the bigger the man to prove it with or on, the better. Falcon was wondering where his dad was and how he was doing. He sensed a presence and looked up into the faces of the two star packers. Very unfriendly faces.
Stand up.
I beg your pardon?
Get on your feet, Lucas!
My name's not Lucas. It's Falcon McAllister. And I'm very comfortable sitting, thank you.
I said get up, you thieving son of a bitch! Lucas or McAllister, it don't make no difference. You're still a horse thief and a rustler.
The sheriff pulled a leather-wrapped cosh from his back pocket and held it up threateningly.
Get up, you scum, or I'll pound your head in where you sit.
Now that would be a real bad mistake, Sheriff.
You making threats again, my brother boy?
My name is McAllister Marshall. I'm from Valley, Colorado. I've done nothing wrong. Now, why don't you gentlemen take a seat and we'll talk about this?
Get up, you bastard!
The sheriff took a swing at Falcon with the blackjack. Falcon ducked the swing and grabbed the edge of the table, overturning it and knocking the two star packers sprawling on the floor. The federal marshal grabbed for his pistol, and Falcon kicked it out of his hand and then put his boot against the side of the man's jaw. The federal marshal kissed the floor out cold. The sheriff was struggling to get to his feet. Falcon helped him, sorta. He reached down, grabbed a handful of the sheriff's shirt, and hit him on the side of the jaw with a powerful right fist. The sheriff's eyes rolled back into his head, and Falcon released the man.
Idiots.
Oh, Jesus! You better get out of town! Now!
What? Why, mister?
Because when them two wakes up, they'll kill you for sure. Them's the Noonan brothers. They're both crazy. And they're Nance Noonan's brothers, both of them.
Who the hell is Nance Noonan?
The he-coon of this part of the territory, son. And you're in his town. Nance Noonan owns everything and damn near everybody in this part of the territory. He owns the N/N ranch.
He's right, mister. Get gone from here as quick as you can. Pride ain't worth dying for. Not my book, anyways.
You do have a point.
I'll saddle your horse whilst you pack your possibles. Then ride, boy. The name McAllister don't mean nothing to men like Nance Noonan.
Shit. Marshall's come too.
I'll kill you, you son of a bitch.
Falcon palmed his gun and shot him.
Get the hell up to your room and pack, son, now.
Falcon bolted upstairs. As he was coming back down the stairs with his bedroll, saddlebags, and rifle, Sheriff Butch Noonan rose to his boots and grabbed for his guns. Falcon lifted the Winchester 44-40 and drilled the man in the center of his chest.
Take off, McAllister! Ride! Ride like old Nicky's after you, as he damn sure is!